right, everybody. Welcome to Famous Monsters Podcast. We're here to talk about horror, sci-fi, fantasy, all things nerdy. We're the Rocketeers, two roommates who haven't lived together in 10 years.
Like over 10 years. Yeah, you guys might know us. We are guest hosts. Famous Monsters asked us to guest host a little while ago. We hosted their episode last week. We have our own podcast called the Launchpad Podcast, and we've been friends with the Famous Monsters guys for a while, so they're bringing us in to pinch hit a couple episodes. We're pretty excited about it. Today is going to be a good one, too.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about some of my favorite movies of all time and a pretty damn good TV show, too.
It's pretty cool when, like, one of the premier monster and horror... I mean, it's not even just a magazine anymore. It's a TV show. It's a podcast. But when a company like Famous Monsters comes to you and is like, hey, would you guys come and talk about zombies for us?
Yep.
You're like, this is awesome. So, zombies, man.
That's right. So, coming up here, October 22nd, The Walking Dead returns
That's
to TV.
That's right. Comes back on AMC the 22nd, so we're almost there. Season 8.
Yeah, it's been going for a long time.
It's a fun show. It's almost like a renaissance where horror has become like superheroes. It's this thing that has always been there, but it's always kind of been on the outskirts, and now it's in the mainstream. So the woman my wife babysits for watches this show.
It's one of my mom's favorite shows.
Which is like, and I love that for the genre.
Yeah.
It's great. And this is a very heavy show. There's so much going on in it. We are starting season 8 in a couple days, October 22nd. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It is on Netflix, all 7 seasons, I believe. And if you want to get some behind-the-scenes stuff, in the Famous Monsters podcast, episode 2, they got to interview Tova Feltscher, who played Deanna Monroe in seasons 5 and 6, right?
Right. So in the show, she is the leader of the Alexandria Safe Zone, and spoiler alert, things don't go super well for her.
Yeah, her son kind of puts an end to that.
She ends up turning into a zombie, and then her son finds her later, and it's this really touching moment where he has to, like, put down his zombie mom.
See, your mom listens to our podcast. Yeah. Mine doesn't. I can easily say that if my mom was a zombie, I could put an end to that threat.
Would it be a drawn-out, like, tearful scene? What song would be playing underneath the scene?
Dude, you know what song would be playing? The bells from the Mr. Sprinkles ice cream truck, because that's my that's my favorite memory of my mom. Is we used to live in Long Island, New York. She used to get a brown bonnet, and I used to get a soft serve vanilla ice cream with rainbow sprinkles. And we would sit on the stoop, and we'd wait for Mr. Softy. We'd go order it, and then we'd sit on the stoop and eat it. So that's it'd be like doo 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 doo. Do, do, do. What about you? Touching scene? What music would be playing?
Not from an ice cream truck.
I'd walk in the other room. You do your mom in one room. I'd do my mom in the other room. I'd walk in and be like, you done yet? Covered in blood. You done yet? You'd be like, dude, Rumi, still touching scene.
Still touching scene. This is hard for me, man.
You want me to do it? Sorry, Mrs. Aaron.
In the magazine, Famous Monsters of Filmland, issue 278, they have an interview with Jennifer Lynch, who directed episodes of The Walking Dead in season 5 and 6. And people might not know this, Jennifer Lynch is David Lynch's daughter.
That's right.
One of the episodes she directed for Walking Dead season 6, episode 2, entitled JSS, I think it's a great episode because it's the one where Carol infiltrates the wolves, the bad group of people. She infiltrates the wolves and secures the armory.
Sure.
And this is a great moment because it's a character who in the comics is dead by issue 42. She's not even around. And the show was like, no, this actor has really brought something to it. And she really has potential to be a great character and has become one of the best characters in the show.
And I think that's one of the best strengths of the show is, you know, a lot of time when you have source material from another medium, you can catch a lot of guff if you stray too far.
Yeah.
But also, if you stay right on point, then everybody knows, everybody at least from the original source material is going to be on board. They know what's coming. So some of the thrills, some of the emotional peaks and ups and downs are not going to be there. But this show, the show Walking Dead, does a great job of departing from the comics just enough. And in my experience so far, just where it makes sense enough. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, oh, let's keep this character alive because it's cool. Or let's keep this character alive because it's a famous actor or actress playing it. But like in this case, this is they depart from the original story and kind of diverge a little bit. And it makes sense, you know? It's a lot of fun.
And it works out to their favor. So season 8's coming out. And this is supposed to adapt the all-out war story arc. And in the comics, this is where Rick and Negan and the survivors of the Alexandria and the Hilltop Colony and the Kingdom take on Negan. And it's going to be Tigers and Rick, Carl, and all the characters fighting Negan.
Rick and Carl and Tigers. Oh my. It's cool. And one of the things, and I think we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I love when you have a story. And in the story, there is an outside threat, in this case, zombies, right?
Yeah.
But you also have the inside threat of other people in your group, people in the next group. I like when you have that where your back is against the wall because you have a threat directly in front of you, but also to your 45, you have, another antagonist coming. It makes the drama heightened. It makes the audience feel less safe. And I like that. And I feel that The Walking Dead, both as a comic and as a show, does a pretty good job of amping up that drama.
Here's a question for you, Rumi. Mm-hmm. In the post-apocalypse...
Is this question also going to make my mom hate me?
No. How soon would you start dressing like a post-apocalyptic person?
Day one.
Day one. Yeah. I would be in like spiked jock strap and hockey mask. Immediately.
Sure. And I would be in a shoulder pads and with a mohawk on the back of your motorcycle immediately.
Immediately. Yeah. People are like, guys, we still have cell phone service. And I'm like, just walk away.
Yeah, because then that same idiot who said I'd have cell phone service gets his hand chopped off by a boomerang. You're like, I told you. You and I have had many pontifications about the different apocalypses that could happen. Apocalypses? Apocalypse? Apocalypses? Apocalypses? Isn't that a movie?
Sure. It's a grammar movie.
We've talked about different things and stuff. I have friends who I have like plans, like if this is what happens, this is where we're going to meet on bikes and this is how we're going to get there and shit. And then my wife is like, okay, and we'll bring the cats. And I'm calling my friend and I'm like, never mind, we're dead. Like that's not going to happen. Like if my wife is worried about bringing our cats to survive the apocalypse, it's like, and I'm like a pretty loyal husband. So like, I can't leave her. I'm just going to sit there and die also.
You're going to fight zombies, man. So yeah, this season, season 8 of The Walking Dead, we see Rick fighting Negan. We'll see who wins, who comes out victorious. I think I know who.
Well, that's the thing is like you think, but what if they change?
What if they change it?
You know, and speaking of change, we saw some interesting things regarding Negan. Negan is such a badass character.
He's terrifying.
In the show. And I think the character is written well and written scary and has cool things to do. But I think Jeffrey Dean Morgan he brings it with that character. And I've liked almost all of his stuff, but this is the leather jacket he was born to fill.
Oh,
you know?
It's service with a smile while he's bashing your brains in. It's
sure.
Horrifying, but he like has such a great attitude about it.
And it's a great personality that he lends to that.
Yeah.
And actually, Aaron and I and the Launchpad podcast, our own podcast, we went to San Diego Comic-Con this past July.
Yep.
It's actually where we hooked up again with the Famous Monsters guys and chatted about podcasting together. But Aaron and I did an episode at San Diego Comic-Con where we noticed a lot of female Negan cosplayers.
Yeah, the lady Negans were out in force.
And like a lot more than male Negans. And then we decided to try to track one down and interview her.
The second we started looking, they disappeared. They went and hit.
But you could check out our episode of the Launchpad podcast. It's episode 14 of 15 where we talk about it. And spoiler alert, we eventually find one and talk about Lady Negan. But Jeffrey Dean Morgan he kills it. And from what we've seen in the trailer, did you see the trailer and the teasers?
Yeah.
And it just looks like that. You know what it looks like? Hmm. And it looks like someone's placing a bomb in one of those trailers. It does have that time bomb feeling, at least the way the trailer was cut.
Oh, it's going to be explosive.
Nice. I see what you did there.
So, yeah, the season 8 premiere is going to serve as the series' milestone 100th episode, and it's directed by the executive producer, Greg Nicotero.
And Greg Nicotero, if you guys don't know, is one of the founders of K&B, which is one of the biggest practical special effects studios in Hollywood. He has done so much, he himself, as well as the company that he started, K&B. And if you are completely unfamiliar, Aaron and I will tell you a little right now, but if you want to go back, in Famous Monsters of Filmland number 283, they talk about his career as well as how he worked with a very famous horror director.
That's right. George Romero. Greg Nicotero. He got his start in Day of the Dead.
That's correct. Not only was he an actor in that film, but he was also Tom Savini, makeup guru Tom Savini's assistant in that movie. He helped with all the effects. And that movie is incredible for effects.
Absolutely, and it's the third film in the famous Unholy Trilogy, which is what we're talking about today.
Yeah,
we're talking about the big three when it comes to zombie movies. The amazing Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, directed by George Romero.
And it's funny because in the Walking Dead Season 8 trailer, I saw a lot of visual callbacks and thematic callbacks to this trilogy. George A. Romero, he was a great director, and he's directed a lot of stuff. He's one of those directors that when you go to his IMDb or you look at like something he directed, you're like, oh, wait, he directed Monkey Shines?
Yeah.
I didn't realize. Like, I didn't realize or remember that. You know that he directed Night, Dawn, and Day of the Dead. You know he did Land of the Dead. You know he did The Crazies. But then you start looking at, like, stuff that he... I mean, first of all, he wrote and he produced so much. But directing, he directed Creepshow. He directed The Dark Half, the Stephen King screenplay. He also directed Knight Riders about, like, knights on motorcycles starring Ed Harris.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, man. Tom Savini's in that as well.
He's done so much. And he, of everything that he's done, he's most well known for...
The Unholy Trilogy. He is the godfather of the zombie genre.
Sure.
We would not have The Walking Dead if it wasn't for George Romero. We wouldn't have any of the zombie genre wouldn't be what it is without his first three movies.
And you and I met him in college, right?
We did.
You never see him be like, yeah, I created this or it was my idea. He's always like, I don't know why people think that zombies eat brains. He's like, I never had them eat brains. And if you go back and watch his stuff, he never has them eat brains, right?
Where did George Romero get his start?
So this is funny, man. And I know we just talked about this same guy.
Tell me, Daniel Tiger.
Dude, George Romero, his first big job was shooting stuff for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
You and Mr. Rogers,
dude,
man.
And I gotta say, I'm in no way ever gonna hide how much I love Mr. Rogers and everything that he did. But like, I promise you, audience and famous monsters of Filmland and anyone else who's listening, Mr. Rogers' Ghost or Mr. Rogers' Zombie. Oh, they should make a Mr. Rogers' Zombie. He'd be the nicest zombie. He would only eat children. Romero was shooting stuff for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, including Mr. Rogers Gets a Tonsillectomy.
People have asked him, what's the scariest thing you've ever shot or the scariest job you ever had? And George Romero says this tonsillectomy was the scariest it's ever been for him because Fred Rogers was a big deal at that
moment. Sure, and it was his first big thing.
Yeah, and he didn't want to mess up the job. Mm-hmm. He also doesn't like real blood, and he's in a surgery room watching a surgery. Yeah. And he's like, I'm about to throw up. And the doctors...
I remember reading about that in college.
Yeah,
man.
And the doctors kept telling him, like, sir, if you're going to throw up, you need to leave. Please, sir. And he's like, no, I don't want to mess this up. I'm trying to film this. And he's like, the whole time.
can we go in for close up?
Close.
Yeah, no, but it's so funny. And I love Mr. Rogers. And he apparently watched Dawn of the Dead out of support for Romero. And told Romero, hey, that was a lot of fun. Just imagine that phone call or that meeting, you know?
I mean, he really inspired me to make my own zombie films.
Sure, sure. And I, you know, you and I have talked about this. I came into special effects, practical special effects, a little later in my life. Yeah. And then I kind of played catch up on all of these movies that are like required reading for getting into effects. Like Dawn and Day were big ones.
Yeah.
But as a director, he really was awesome because he was like an auteur's auteur. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? He wasn't like a big Hollywood guy. He wasn't part of the Hollywood scene.
Right.
For Knight, now Knight was in 68. He and his team, you know, his film production team, they with their own money, on their own self, they made 14 prints of the movie. They handled all their own promotions, all their own marketing. They opened the original movie in 14 local movie theaters, and they financed a world premiere like on Halloween night, but like themselves, you know?
Back then, you were able to walk up to a movie theater and say, hey, I have a movie. Do you want to play it in your movie theater? And they had the choice to do that. You know, you couldn't do that today. I couldn't take my movie to AMC and be like, hey, guys.
Do you guys want to screen Roomies, the Roomie movie?
The Roomie movie?
What's it about? Two guys that'll live together?
All right, so you want to dive into Night of the Living Dead?
Yeah, dude.
All right, 1968, Night of the Living Dead is released. It is the original zombie movie. They had zombies before this, but they were like voodoo zombies and magic zombies. It wasn't living dead people. And this really set the tone. And this movie's amazing. It's black and white, so much atmosphere, such great characters. It lays down so many of the tropes that come into later zombie movies.
Yep.
Rumi, what do you got about Night of the Living Dead?
I read a bunch of stuff. I mean, a lot of people will say Night of the Living Dead was a metaphor for racism or this or that in our society.
Yeah.
George Romero, in multiple interviews, I've read him just go, like, no, I just wanted to make a movie about ghouls attacking a bunch of people, and the people also have human issues, that miscommunication and stuff that they have with each other. I saw something where he said, like, it was a Vanity Fair interview. He actually said, a cigar is just a cigar. I just wanted to make a horror movie.
It's because it was one of the first movies to have a lead actor who was black.
Played
by Dwayne Jones. And Romero just said, he was my friend who said he would be in my movie. And we didn't have a lot of money.
Sure.
We couldn't pay him very much. And he was like, no, I'll be in it. Sure. But to put kind of a context, the time frame of this, the night they're driving to New York City with the finished film in their trunk, they had literally just finished the movie, and they're driving it to New York.
To try to get investors,
right? To try and get investors.
For distribution.
To sell it. While they're driving, they hear on the radio that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And suddenly they look at each other and go, man, now our movie has a lot of weight attached to it that we didn't expect, but we'll roll with it. Another reason that this really rings in that time period, you know, just after the assassination of Martin Luther King, is at the end of the movie, the main character, the black guy, gets shot by a gang of white rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
They mistake him for a zombie.
Sure.
But the metaphor is there, and you can't help but make those comparisons. But man, when I saw this the first time, it destroyed me.
I agree, man. I agree. That was one of the first times that I can remember. And I grew up a movie kid. I always was watching movies.
Yep.
And I watched a lot of movies that were ahead of my time. Like, as a kid, I watched this movie, you know? And I remember the first time I saw it. I remember standing in my living room as the videotape rewound. And I remember in my little kid mind being like, what just happened?
Yeah.
Like, he survived that whole night. And it wasn't like he got killed at the end by a zombie or got killed in the end by another human who he was arguing with. It was an accident. And they didn't even know. Unreal, man.
It's unreal. It's haunting.
Just in my mind, it's just the cinematic cherry on top of that perfect horror movie.
It really is. I think it is.
It really makes it a classic.
It is a new classic. I think this will forever be a great horror classic. I think it's up there with, you know, the original classics of the Frankensteins and the Draculas.
Romero has gone on record and said numerous times that he didn't and won't show zombie actors how to zombie shuffle. Like, a lot of people, oh, where'd you get the idea? I didn't do that. He was afraid that if he said zombies should do like this and do it, that those background actors and zombies, even featured zombies, whoever, would just copy his exact movements.
Yeah.
So he just said, act dead, act dead. So people would just do what they thought, which when you watch a scene of any of the, you know, these three movies, there are some scenes that have 20, 30, 40, 50 people in them.
Yeah.
It doesn't look coordinated, which I think works for it.
It's kind of creepy because in this specifically, some of them are just kind of standing there. Some of them are like shivering and shaking, like something seriously wrong with them while they're dead.
Undead.
That inconsistency is unnerving, and I think it worked to his favor.
Sure.
Which is weird that actually worked.
What can you think off the top of your head? Can you think of any one zombie that you like the most? Like, what, like the action of the zombie, like the movement?
In the first one, I mean, there's this scene where they're fighting over intestines.
Yep.
And it's a couple of zombies just like juggling intestines and trying to eat them.
Yep.
And they try to go for it, and he like pushes the other zombie, like zombies fighting over food, and that's just creepy. It's really a good creepy moment.
And then in this one, you have the first zombie we see.
Yeah.
And the first scene. I mean, I just watched this movie recently.
Yeah.
It is one of those movies that, to me, I mean, it's not flawless, but it can do no wrong. And it really is crafted from a storytelling cinematic point of view. It's beautiful. The opening scene, Barbara and Johnny driving in their car to the cemetery. It totally sets the scene. It has a great tone.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
It establishes those characters as people, as brother and sister. You're emotionally attached to them right away. And then this creepy guy walks up, boom, he's a zombie. And if you've have anything about anything, you know he's going to be a zombie before he gets there. But it's so awesome, and he does such a great job. And it's understated. Like, we talk about horror today, it wouldn't be the same now. They wouldn't open that movie the same way.
Well, and here's a weird thing. It's right off the bat, that first zombie that attacks Johnny and Barbara's stuck in the car trying to turn it on, the zombie picks up a rock right off the bat.
Yes,
they're
right.
Using tools.
Yep.
Right off the first movie.
And this movie establishes the shit out of that, yeah, because there's multiple times where they
multiple
use tools.
Times. Tools, trowels, whatever they got.
A little gardening action,
yeah,
in the old mom chest. This movie is actually pretty cool, too. Not only is the opening amazing, but the ending, there's an interesting thing about the very, very ending. Did you know that this movie was originally going to be called something different?
Yeah, originally it was going to be called Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Correct, but they couldn't call it that because there was already a movie called
Flesh Eaters.
So because of legal BS, they wanted to change the name so that they wouldn't have to deal with that. So they changed it to Night of the Living Dead. I don't know if they forgot or just didn't, but they didn't change all the copyright stuff. So now Night of the Living Dead is in the public domain. It's one of the most famous movies in public
domain.
That's
why you can find it in every DVD compilation that's ever made. Everybody just throws it in there because they can.
My dad has released a couple editions of Night of the Living Dead just because he could do it. We talked about how this movie establishes a lot of the zombie mythos. Let's say for American horror films, because before this, it was very big in voodoo. You know, zombies were very big in voodoo, but it was all like Caribbean island type stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was very
magic and
it,
voodoo,
right. It was very rooted in that. What are some of the other things that are established in this movie?
It takes a while for them to get there, but about an hour into it, we see the zombies biting people.
Sure.
And that establishes that, well, and the fact that there's a little girl who has been bitten, it establishes that bites can transfer the disease that turns you into a zombie.
And that's it. We hear on the news in the movie numerous times that the zombies are devouring the flesh of their victims.
Yep.
We hear that a lot. And an hour and 16 minutes in, we are told by the parents that the girl in the basement was bitten.
Yeah.
That's the first time we've heard of a zombie biting someone, not eating someone.
And
we've seen zombies eating. Yeah, exactly. So you got Mr. Cooper, right? Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
Oh, man. Barbara gets this house, this farmhouse, and she meets Ben, who is our other hero, and Mr. Cooper, who is the head of this family. Mr. Cooper, his wife, and his daughter have locked themselves in the basement. And then there is two other people, and it's
Judy, and I think it's Thomas is his name.
And they're just some other goobers who happen to be at the house. But Mr. Cooper is like a hard ass. He's all tough as nails.
Yeah, he is the human antagonist in this story. And like we said before, in a story, a movie, a comic, a novel like this, it is important, it's almost necessary to have that secondary antagonist, and that is Mr. Cooper. Ben boards up the entire lower level of the house, and then these people come up from the basement, the cellar, and Mr. Cooper is like just immediately antagonizing the shit out of Ben, and he's all over him. Why would you want to stay up here? There's windows. We should be downstairs. And eventually Ben turns around and he goes, you want to go downstairs? You go downstairs. You be the boss down there. I'm boss up here. And it's just, it sets off this tension between them for the whole movie, which I feel is balanced on a needle point perfectly.
Yeah.
The whole film.
And here's something I really like about this, that I think many have replicated and very rarely is it beaten. But this, like, plays out in such a human way.
Mm.
And even though Mr. Cooper is a jerk, he's not like a sadist or a monster. He's putting his foot down to do what he thinks will protect his family.
Sure. And I think that's the best part. And I'm going to get into this with the next thing I want to talk about this movie. But it really does an amazing job of crafting these characters.
Yep.
And a lot of movies now, I feel like, you know, the guy walks up, he's like, hi, I'm Mr. Cooper. I'm a businessman. And my wife is downstairs. We're having marital problems and my kid was bit and I'm worried about it. It doesn't say that.
Yeah.
As he says his dialogue, you find those things out. It's character development. It's not just throwing that shit at your feet. You don't even know that they have a kid downstairs. You don't even know that he has a wife or a kid downstairs for a little bit. Then eventually you realize she's down there and something's the matter with her. Then they say she's bit. And by that point, you should know that that's going to be a problem from the news reports you've been hearing. But it's very interesting at the end when Mr. Cooper meets his demise, he stumbles down those steps and the last thing he does as a living human is grasp towards his dying daughter and he falls down dead, which I think is like the ultimate human thing, right? This guy who we think is a bastard the last thing he wanted to see before he died was his daughter. And I think that's almost like bring a tear to your eye.
It's
deep
tragic.
Character development. Yeah.
It's tragic because here's what's even weirder. A bigger tragedy is he ends up being right. Hiding in the basement saves them.
And that was the point I wanted to make as well. Ben lives because he runs down the basement. And we'll talk about this when we get to Day. Day of the Dead has a couple characters who are just character sketches of racist idiots who are just hateful to be hateful. There's no backstory. There's no reason for it. Mr. Cooper thinks he's doing what's right. Now, right or wrong, he's doing it in a very jerkish way.
And this is something that Phil brought up when we talked to him at Comic-Con.
Exactly.
He said, the best villains think they're right.
Absolutely.
In their heart of hearts, they believe that they are doing the best thing. And I think that it makes Mr. Cooper such a great antagonist, not because he's a bad guy, but because he is doing his best to be in control of his family and his life.
Sure.
Which I can't blame him for, but...
No, and that's it. He's
kind of stubborn. Stubborn about it that
he will sacrifice everyone else in that house to save him and his family, at least the daughter. And that's... I feel like the wife goes after him a couple times, and they lay down groundwork that there's problems in that marriage, that relationship. But ultimately, I feel if nothing else, him going down the stairs and trying to look at his daughter one last time shows that everything he's been doing so far has been for her.
Well, let's get to it while we're down there. What happens to the daughter?
I think she's fine. She leaves. The daughter turns into a zombie and starts eating his dead body.
Yep.
Which then turns him into a dead body.
Oh.
Mom comes down to check out the scene, and while making weird squeaking noises, she gets stabbed to death by the daughter with a trowel.
That scene right there, almost as much, up until the ending, that scene scarred me. I was scarred at that
moment. How old were you, do you think, when the first time you saw it?
11, 12.
Okay, yeah, I was probably about the same age.
They gave it to me on VHS out of a dollar bargain bin. Mm-hmm. It definitely did not have nice packaging on this thing, you know.
That was the edition that my dad released.
That moment, because the mom screams and it's not natural. It gets warped,
yes.
Pitch warped, and they're doing weird audio things to it.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets stabbed again and again and again by her daughter with a gardening trowel.
Sure.
And it's so freaky and gnarly. Not very gory, but really well put together that it's very shocking and very stark and pretty brutal.
And it's one of those things when you go back and examine it, similar to the Psycho shower scene.
Yeah.
When you go back and look at it, it's not that graphic. It's certainly not by today's standards. But when you look at what you actually see shot to shot, you don't see as much gore and graphic stuff as you think you see.
Yeah,
but you're right. It is definitely a heavy scene. You know what probably my absolute favorite scene in the movie is? Shortly after we're introduced to Ben, Barbara is still almost walking around comatose. She's almost like her own zombie.
Yeah.
He is trying to board up the house. So he needs to break apart this kitchen table. While he's breaking apart the table, he tells this story about how he came to the house. And I think that is probably the most chilling part of the movie.
Awesome.
And to me, this is what movies today, certainly horror movies, are lacking. They're going to throw a CG stutter step clown at your face while screaming, but they're not going to think about some heart and some story. He tells this story about watching a truck on fire with zombies hanging from it crash through a billboard and explode. And he explains watching this, and you can see it. You can see it in your mind, and as he's going about his work of getting ready to board up the house, you can see in this actor's face that he sees it.
Yeah.
And he says that he's surrounded by these zombies now, and he looks to this diner that he was at, and nobody is doing anything. Nobody's going to try to help him. And I feel like that story, you know, they couldn't show that in this movie. They didn't have the budget. They didn't have the time. But they wrote it, and he performed it in such a way that you feel there through him. You can see him remembering this, the way he says. And he says he got into a car and he just wanted to destroy them. And he just started running them over. And he says they didn't move. They didn't try to get out of the way. They just stood there. And you could see there that his character can't understand what's going on. They can't understand why those things wouldn't have a self-preservation instinct. And it didn't stop him. And it's just, you think about it as a storytelling device, it's exposition, right? We now, as the audience, know more about the zombies through this story, which is very important.
It's haunting.
Absolutely. That's the greatest word for it.
And like you said, this movie is full of these moments. And later they show, he tells you what he saw. And then they show you some of the rules that he's put out in this story, that the zombies aren't afraid, that you can run them over and they don't move. This all comes into play, but by telling the story, they're setting you up to already be nervous about it. And I think that, that like you said, that is one of the best moments in this movie. And it's just two people talking while he takes apart a table.
It's not even two people talking, man, because she's out of it.
Yeah.
It is him, his character, Ben, trying to come to terms with this. You could tell this is his brain catching up to his body and being like, whoa.
What did I just
see? We got to figure that. Like, what is happening here?
In the movie, what do they state is the reason the zombies are alive?
Radiation from space, right?
A satellite has crashed.
It's making part of their brains go. And
Classic. Actually,
they tell that. How do they give that information to the audience?
Through the TV, through the radio. We see a TV broadcast where they're talking to the sheriff, and mm-hmm. It has one of my lines. You can shoot them in the head. They go down pretty quick. They're all messed
up. They're dead. They're all messed up.
Yeah, I love that.
And I actually love the device, the storytelling device, of getting exposition through fake news.
Yeah.
In my opinion, this is the best. This, as well as the Orson Welles War of the Worlds story on the radio drama, those two things, I no joke, look at my arm, I have goosebumps. As a storytelling device, I think it is so effective and lends such credibility to what you're trying to do. And this movie has a radio, has a television. It shows us multiple interviews from the point of the interviewers. Part of the contention of whether we should hide in the cellar or hide in the first level of the house is where the radio and television are. And when the mother, Helen, the mother of the little girl, Helen Cooper, when she finds out that the radio is upstairs, she immediately starts bagging on Mr. Cooper about, they have the radio upstairs?
Yeah.
We need to be upstairs. And it's funny because, like we said before, a cigar is just a cigar. This is supposed to be a horror movie. But think about how important, how crucial contact with society is. She specifically says, they have a television and radio up there. What if people come looking? What if people are going to tell us what we're supposed to do?
Yeah.
And if you think about that shit, like, what would we do if we didn't have TV? You wouldn't know what you're supposed to do in a crisis.
And I think it also helps make the world bigger. This could be a very claustrophobic movie, but the radio and the TV help flesh out what's happening outside of this.
Absolutely.
The stories that he tells.
Absolutely.
And the radio and the TV help flesh out a much bigger, richer environment other than just in a farmhouse.
This is a trope that I love, is the news and news devices, news reports in a horror movie.
That is a great trope, and this movie lays out a lot of the tropes that become, standard for zombies.
It has a couple tropes that I do not like.
Oh.
Personally.
Tell me.
I can't stand the hysterical girl in a movie.
Yeah.
It's very important. I understand it. This is the example of a hysterical girl that bothers me the least, but like Jaws 2, there's a hysterical crying girl the whole time, and I'm like, overboard.
Yeah.
That's chum for me. Johnny said we should have candy, but we didn't have any. Shut up. I'm boarding up. Listen to my story about a fiery truck.
She is very difficult to get along with in this movie.
It's very important, and there's other things like devices and things in movies that have to be there, but like I just can't stand that.
When Tom Savini remade this movie in the 90s, the Barbara became a badass.
Correct, which was awesome. And that was cool. And we could do a whole episode about the remake also. There was a 1990, but it was in the 90s remake of the original Night of the Living Dead. The other thing real quick in this one, that it doesn't make a big deal in this, but music boxes. Annie, if you are on celluloid, or in this case, nowadays digital media, and you're looking at a music box, you're transfixed. You can't gaze at a music box if it's on. First of all, if it's not on, you got to go turn it on. Second of all, if you turn it on, you have to stare at a Dreamlike for a second. And I just can't stand that. It's in this. It's in Labyrinth. It's in Cabin in the Woods. And like, I get it. But like, ugh.
You got to watch that ballerina spin around a couple times. Yeah.
I cannot wait to the apocalypse where you are dressed in your hockey mask and I have my mohawk and we're hiding out in a house and we just boarded everything up and we both look at the music box and that ballerina's not moving yet.
Ding, dong, ding, 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 ding. And it just reminds you of a simpler time. What does it remind you of? Having music boxes and all those other times of music boxes.
When we are sheltered in a house an abandoned house with zombies outside waiting for the climactic fight where we shoot our way out.
Yeah.
And I look at that music box, it's going to remind me of every other stupid freaking music box I've ever seen in
everybody,
cinema.
You're right. Everybody. Men, women, other zombies. Everybody opens up the music box and is like, huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're like, maybe I just didn't have a music box growing up, so that doesn't speak to me on a personal level, but... Yeah, but those are two things. The crazy girl who can't handle her crap in the middle of a crisis and the music box. I can't get over those.
So this movie influenced me a lot. And in college, my big film that I made for our film, too, You Make a Movie, mm-hmm. I did a zombie movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Love Afterlife, and it was about two zombies that find each other that were, like, in love in real life, and they find each other during the zombie apocalypse
oh,
and,
nice.
Like, recognize each other.
By the way, thanks for having me work on that. Sarcastically, he didn't.
I didn't.
We worked together and we did a lot of stuff together in college. I'm just giving him crap.
But we found like an abandoned farmhouse, and it really is just an homage to Night of the Living Dead. But along the way, it was so hard to get this movie made because everybody was just like, oh, you're making a zombie movie. That's not really a legitimate genre.
Right.
When we played this movie at the film screening, at the big film screening where everybody showed their movies,
mm-hmm.
mine was the only one that got a standing ovation before the movie was over while the zombies are ripping this guy to pieces and like pulling out his guts and stuff.
Awesome.
People started clapping and cheering, and then they just stood up. That didn't happen for any other movies. And
I didn't see that because the scene that you had where the people walked up to the music box, I was like, I'm out, I'm and out. I left.
There was no music box. There's a radio, though.
Okay, I'm in.
So afterwards, the president of our college, Jackie Liebergott.
Emerson College.
Emerson College, where we both went. She came up to me and goes, I really enjoyed your movie. And I'm like, does she have me mistaken with another movie? You know, one of the artsy films that would make an art school proud, not the zombie gore fest that mm-hmm. mine was. She goes, no. I was in a zombie movie, and I'm like, what? Oh,
that's right.
And she goes, I was in Night of the Living Dead, and I about, like, lost it. I was like, what?
That's right.
And she was like, yeah, I was in Baltimore at the time, and somebody said, do you want to be in a movie? And Baltimore is where they filmed Night of the Living Dead. And she said she and her friends went out to this film location and then just, like, hung out on set, and they're in the movie in the background near some trees just kind of, like, stumbling around. And they were like, yeah, we're having fun. And
That's awesome.
We had no clue what it was or what we were supposed to be doing. And I'm like, that's hysterical. But she's in the original Night of the Living Dead.
That's awesome. And, you know, I really, it's funny that you say she was the president of our college. We went to Emerson College. Emerson College is where I figured out that I wanted to do special effects. And when I did that, you know, people who knew a little bit more than me, and I went online and obviously did some research, like, you got to watch these movies. Yeah. Now, at that time, I had seen Dawn of the Dead, but I hadn't really watched it. So I rediscovered it for the first time in college.
Yeah.
And I watched it again. I watched it recently. I watched it this week, actually, for the first time in years. It's awesome.
Dawn of the Dead, 1978.
Awesome, 1978. I hate the blue makeup zombies.
Yeah.
But you know what? Come on.
They're not supposed to be blue, though. Like, he said they were going to, like, color correct that out. They were supposed to be gray, but,
is that
color
true?
Correction... I don't know if that's true or just something they say to try
like
and explain
it. Like he saw Sin City and was like, oh, no, the yellow bastard was actually blue, but then they were going to make him yellow digitally.
But the thing is, like, why haven't we gotten a color-corrected version? I mean...
They don't have the technology yet.
Yeah, right? I mean...
George Lucas, if you could put a frickin' Ronto in Mos Eisley, you could color-correct some blue zombies.
Tauntaun?
Ronto.
What's a Ronto?
It's actually better you don't know. In the special edition of episode 4... He's Googling Ronto. It's the big, stupid Brontosaurus-looking thing that the Jawas are riding,
dumb,
and they fall off in the special
dumb,
edition.
Dumb. Super dumb.
I only know that because I didn't always be interested in girls.
But yeah, Dawn of the Dead, man. The makeup's weird. It's very long. Like, it's an opus of a movie.
Sure.
But this movie is amazing.
It takes place in the universe. It takes place a couple weeks, I believe, after the original Night of. I think it takes a great premise. Okay, we have a helicopter, a couple main characters. Where can we go? They land on top of a mall, which has a helipad for some reason. But, like, let's just go with it. And they're in this mall now. And what do? They get some trucks. They board up the entrances with 18-wheeler trucks.
They secure it the best they can.
Kill all the zombies in the mall, then live a life.
But this has become, like, this really is the archetype. I think, you know, where Night of the Living Dead started, this is the archetype
for
all zombie movies and shows. It's how do you survive afterwards?
Sure, I agree.
How do you board up? And it's always a mall. In Walking Dead, it's a prison. Like, it is the archetype. And you really see these human moments. A little fun fact, the second SWAT team guy, the white SWAT team guy,
yep.
His daughter was my neighbor my freshman year at Emerson.
Oh, really?
Emerson has a lot of very strange...
You have a lot of very strange...
George Romero connections. Yeah.
We met... Yeah, that's true. I guess that's true, right? This is the third time now that we're mentioning Emerson in this podcast.
It'll come up again.
It's true. This movie is great, though, and you're right. It does set the stage a lot. Again, it's just, you know, Romero introduces zombies to pretty much American cinema in Night of the Living Dead. Dawn takes it to the next level.
Yeah.
You and I have talked about this before. In Night of the Living Dead, most of the zombies are just grabbing people, yeah. throwing them to the ground, killing them, hitting them. In this one, the zombies start biting. Now, they mention a bite in Night, yeah. but we never see a yeah. bite. We see eating of dead bodies and killing, but we don't see bites. In this, multiple people get bit. The zombies are actively trying to bite.
They're gnarly. This movie's sure. really gory, and it's one of the staples of gore makeup and gory films. And, I mean, right off the bat, it starts with the SWAT team, like, attacking this apartment complex where people are, like, hiding dead bodies that are zombies.
Right.
For religious reasons or whatever. And the SWAT team just starts killing people, and zombies are biting people. And they go down in the basement, and they find, like, a room where they're keeping all these zombies who are apparently, you know, the dead bodies of their loved ones who mm-hmm. have died. And there's a weird fact I got for you here.
Yeah, this is weird.
So in that scene where they go down in the basement, and there's, like, a cage with these zombies in there. In the corner, there's a corpse wrapped up in a sheet and tied up with a rope. Actually a real skeleton.
No.
Yes. So this
a real
skeleton. Tom Savini was lent this skeleton, which everyone thought was a prop. They didn't know it was a real corpse. He was lent it as a prop. He brought it to set, covered it in makeup, and used it in the movie.
Did Savini know it was real?
No. Nobody did. Everybody thought it was a prop. So then, it's in the movie. Savini gives the skeleton back to the person he borrowed it from. That person sells it to a costume shop, and it sits in the window for years. And then one day, some police show up to rent costumes from the costume shop, and they're like, that's a real skeleton in your window. And they're like, no. And they're like, yeah. And they do some tests, find out, yeah, it's a real skeleton. It gets buried, but they can't find out who it is.
It's resurrected later and attacks people in a mall.
Well, that would have been a better twist, but... Turns out the skeleton...
There's still time. We just wait for that satellite to crash.
Right, right there.
I'm sorry, I keep blowing up your story. They bury the real skeleton. They finally bury
skeleton.
It.
They find out it's over 100 years old. It's a woman. They don't know how she died, but they name it Dawn Doe after being in Dawn of the Dead. And for the longest time, it didn't have a headstone. It was an unmarked grave. But the woman who owned the costume shop where the body was, where Dawn Doe was sitting for years... paid to have a marker made for it. So she hopefully is not going to be haunted by that ghost. But
that's very interesting. And, you know, I don't know what you believe in as far as, like, afterlife, but some people believe that your soul, your spirit, whatever, can't rest until yep. your earthly remains are put to rest.
Yep.
So can you imagine when Dawn Doe finally, like, arrives in heaven? She's like, you guys are not going to believe
yeah.
what happened.
Like, wait, you were in a movie where people are eating flesh?
Yeah, and then I, like, kind of worked at this thrift shop.
How could they not notice that this was a real skeleton? If the cops walked in and were like, you got a skeleton in your window.
What kind of thrift store puts a skeleton in the window anyway?
It's a costume shop.
Okay. That's a very interesting. There's a lot of stories about this movie, and this yep. movie also was one of Tom Savini's big moments where he was suddenly in the world of film, and, you know, average people were starting to know him.
And he's in the movie too.
Yes, he plays a biker, and I think he gets shot at the towards the end of that. But
he's running around with the machete, just hacking up.
Does
zombies.
Some really cool, a great machete to the head gag.
Yep.
He's got some good kills, and there's some great effects. Let's talk about some of the effects in this real quick.
One of my personal favorites. It's when they're trying to gas up the helicopter, and the zombie with a very silly looking head, but it makes sense. Walks up and runs into the helicopter blade.
Because there's boxes, there's crates on the edge of the helipad.
Yeah.
And instead of walking around, this enterprising zombie tries to go over the crates. So he stands on the crates, which boosts his height.
And his head gets into the blades of the chopper, and it just goes, thung, 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 thung.
Awesome.
Knocking off his head a little bit at a time. And it's amazing. It looks so good. Mm-hmm. And you're like, how did they do that? Well, we'll tell you. The helicopter blades weren't there to begin with.
Sure.
They put that in later so that he's not in real danger, but his head was built with like stacks, different layers that could be yanked off with fishing line one at a time so that it looked like it got cut off in segments.
Oh, so cool. It's such a great idea. It's such a great gag. Nowadays, you'd have to make that ultra gory for it to be passed off as okay.
It would never be practical nowadays.
Absolutely. And it would just... it would read as silly or corny unless you did it over-the-top gory. But this movie itself is a little silly. Definitely. Night of the Living Dead was completely on the cuff. It was completely on the level. This one has a couple moments where it's kind of thumbing its nose, not necessarily at the audience, but just in general. It has a little fun.
It's having fun. It definitely is. This one did have commentary associated, where the first one was a scary movie. This one had commentary about capitalism and consumer nature and like how we're all zombies to buy stuff. That's why it's in a mall. There's a lot of other like certain dead characters that like, you know, there's a dead Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just kind of wandering around in his orange robes with his tambourine. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of little subtle hints at that.
Sure. But there are like that as a theme, there is a comedic element to this movie where at one point they turn on all the power of the film of the mall.
Yeah.
And escalators start going and zombies are tripping and music starts and like zombies are falling into water fountains that are spraying and the music is kooky and it really kind of lends itself to like, whoa, it's almost like Sam Raimi-esque in my opinion.
Well, and I don't think it's in the theatrical version, but in the director's cut, there's a whole scene where they go into a bakery, load up on pies.
The human marauder biker characters do when they take over the mall.
And they load up on pies and start doing a pie fight with zombies, like running up and just smashing them in the face with pies.
Sure.
So it's all these zombies with pies in their face.
And it's crazy kooky music and stuff. And it's like, I guess like, it's an interesting thing. And I usually hate that kind of junk, but it doesn't feel out of place. In the context of this movie, it's good. There's numerous scenes where our protagonists who are now in the mall are shopping and they're like taking stuff from stores, but they're like having a good time with it and stuff. And I guess you'd, as a human, you would have to do that.
Well, and this is something I like. You get to see moments where they are just in stasis. They are happy.
Mm-hmm.
They find moments where they are not in constant peril. And I think that that is really important when you show humanity and you're trying to show a slice of humanity. Like, it's one thing if there's an action movie because they're usually go, go, go. This shows like an extended period of time about how these people live in this zombie apocalypse. And I'm really glad that they show moments where they're just having dinner together. They're happy. They're finding what little things they can hang on to that keep them human.
Sure, sure. It's not super miserable. Although they're in a tough plight, they're making do. And you as the audience feel that they are not miserable. And that is kind of important if that's the story you're crafting.
Exactly, exactly. And for something that shows a big period of time, I think that is important. What's one of your favorite kills in this movie?
One of my favorite effects, and I guess it's a kill, is also it is, in my opinion, the stupidest part of the movie. Do you know where I'm going with this?
I do.
The Marauder guys come in, the motorcycle gang, and they're all, like, smashing stuff and breaking stuff. They're stealing, like, I mean, everyone's stealing, I guess, because no one's paying for anything. But they're stealing jewelry and stuff that you would not need in the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
But during that scene, there's no zombies in the mall yet. One of the bikers jumps into one of those machines that you stick your arm in and it takes your blood pressure.
Yeah.
He's doing that while all the bikers are like messing around. Another biker runs up to him. He's like, come on, man, what are you doing? Why are you messing around with this thing? And he yanks him out. Later, the zombies pile into the mall and there's a huge...
Because the marauders have broken down the defenses,
exactly.
The zombies now can get in.
And first there's a pie fight, like you said, and there's all this other junk. But then the human protagonists start shooting and picking off the Marauders.
Yeah.
So now there's this big three-way fight between the protagonist humans, the Marauder humans, and the zombies. So the zombies start to devour the bikers and destroy them.
Oh, it's amazing.
So eventually the bikers retreat out of the mall, but that same guy's like, wait, wait, wait. I got to know what my blood pressure is. My BPM, I got to know if it's over 180, whatever. He runs in. While the zombies are killing people,
yeah,
he runs in and you see him look like he's trying to get away with something, jump into this chair, stick his arm in the cuff. The cuff closes on his arm, pretty much like securing him to that thing. And zombies immediately run over, start biting and pulling on him. They rip him out of the machine, but his arm stays there. And it's a great rip. Like when you watch his arm get ripped off, it looks amazing.
Oh, it's gnarly.
And, you know, he gets devoured then. And it's great. But that's the coolest and the stupidest scene in the whole movie, in my opinion. You know?
But, I mean, this is the first time in a movie where we see, like, full-on disembowelment.
Absolutely. Like, and people are getting trashed.
It is gnarly. In my fledgling makeup artist days, I was like, whoa!
Yep. Same with me. And I had seen this before, but this is the first time as a professional I was watching it to see how it was done. And then right after that, probably the same day in college, for the first time I watched Day of the Dead.
Where Dawn of the Dead is amazing and really ups the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Day of the Dead, I don't know if it surpasses that bar that Dawn set.
Which bar?
As good as it, like,
like,
I think,
a movie? Zombie movie?
I think Dawn of the Dead is maybe one of the best zombie movies you could have.
Okay.
It's archetypal. It goes further than Night of the Living Dead, which is a classic.
Mm-hmm.
But Day, I don't know if it surpasses it, but of the trilogy, it is probably my favorite one because not only of the effects, but the situation that these people are in. And it starts out very bleak. It's people in a helicopter.
Sure.
Searching, and it's just empty streets, and there's like alligators and animals running the empty streets, and zombies just kind of sitting around while somebody's screaming, "Hello,
is there anyone there?
Hello,"
Hello.
Which is sampled in some Gorillaz songs.
Dude, I love you. That's why we're roomies, even though we don't live together.
Right off the bat, we see an amazing zombie, and his nickname is Dr. Tongue. And it's his jaw's missing. It's just this giant tongue.
That's during the title card of the movie, Day of the Dead. And I'm not going to lie. I watched this movie literally last night, and I rewound it twice to watch that. Because I think it's a puppet.
Yeah.
But my first thought was, how'd they do that makeup? And I rewound it. I don't think it's a makeup. Did it again. It's so good. It's so good.
It's a puppet, but its eyes move, and that really is the cool part about it.
Mm-hmm. The effects in this movie stand out. Again, Tom Savini's doing the effects. This is a little less than 10 years later. Dawn was 1978. Mm-hmm. This is Day. It's 1985. Dr. Tongue. I didn't know his name was Dr. Tongue. I mean, it's great. The title card puppet was incredible. There is a main character zombie named Bub. His makeup is great, and that actor does an fantastic job.
Amazing. Let's set up where it is. So the people in the helicopter, they can't find anybody. They fly back to a military base that's underground.
Right.
And the whole movie is kind of these military, what's left of a military battalion,
mm-hmm.
which is not very many people, and some scientists.
Right.
And they're in this underground bunker just kind of trying to be like, well, what do we do now? I think it's all over. I don't think there's anything left for society.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do?
There's two groups. There's like a scientist group that's trying to figure out zombies, not necessarily create a cure, but figure out something to do with them.
Yeah.
And then almost at this point in the story, an opposing military.
Yeah.
Very like, let's shoot everybody.
Yeah. And that's where this movie takes place. And the environment's really cool. It's like underground. There's like salt mines that they've built this base into.
Mm-hmm.
They've captured a bunch of zombies, and mm-hmm. they're just trying to figure out what to do with them. There's a creepy scientist who's doing experiments on them.
Nicknamed Frankenstein, who he's trying to domesticate them. But yeah, that's what he's trying to do.
Kinda.
Is make them work for them, be able to take orders.
Well, and he has this pet zombie named Bub, who, like you said, does such a great job of kind of like humanizing the zombies. And George Romero had this idea that if you let zombies be long enough, they would kind of redevelop certain habits.
Sure, because it really, the character of a zombie evolves through the series. Because I believe this one, Day of the Dead, I believe this is supposed to take place months after the original Night of the Living Dead.
He would, you know, try and develop this more in later films, but I think Bub does the best you could do. I think saying like a zombie would learn to do new stuff might turn me off.
Sure.
I'm still in for Bub.
Agreed.
Bub does a great job. I think in later, like Land of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
I get a little turned off by how much the zombies learn.
Agreed.
But I'm still in for Bub. He does a great job. And
a lot of that is the performance.
Oh, it's so good.
This is the linchpin for me, okay?
Yeah.
I just Facebooked about this. When you make a movie and you have, it's usually a zombie eating something that humans don't usually eat, usually other humans, you don't have to show the zombie going, "Arm, yum, 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 yum." Like, I know it's gross. I know you're eating. That's not how anyone eats anything.
Yeah.
And anytime, you know, 9 out of 10 times in a movie when you have a character eating something gross, like fish, faces or freaking monkey brains or whatever, it's like,
yeah.
Just eat it regular. Bub is the doctor is giving Bub human remains to eat at one point, and he eats it what I would consider normal.
Yeah.
And in my mind, I watched it last night, I'm telling you, and I was like, that is the best performance in this entire film, just because he's doing it, quote unquote, real.
There's two Bub parts that I love. And one is they put headphones on him.
Yeah.
And he hears music, mm-hmm. and he recognizes it. Maybe not the song. He's not tapping his toes and snapping his fingers. He's not singing along.
Because it's Beethoven, but yet. Yeah.
But it awakens something in him. And the look on his face is pretty wild. Like slack-jawed and amazed, but
sure.
Still wild. And what's the other big Bub moment?
For me, it would be he's given a Gillette-type razor.
Yeah.
And he... The suspicion is to see if he remembers to shave. And he looks at it, and he does start... He shaves his cheek once or twice, and he peels off a little bit of his skin.
Another really cool effect.
And that's a very subtle effect.
Yep.
But the thing there that wins me over is, in all these things where Bub is given something from his previous humanoid life,
yeah.
The way the actor physically holds the things in his hands, they give him a book. The way he picks up the book... It's not how people pick up a book, but it's not like how your local theater actor would pretend to pick up a book as a zombie. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It is very, it's almost like when people act drunk in movies. No one acts drunk like real people are drunk in real life. It's so overstated. The actor who plays Bub does this amazing job of picking up this book in a way that I believe his hands are not ready to pick up a book at that point. And it's just a subtle performance. Watch, next time you see that movie, Aaron and anyone who's listening to this podcast, watch how that actor uses his hands in that specific scene. It's unreal.
In the movie, the doctor, Dr. Frankenstein, names the zombie Bub after his father, which I don't know about you, but I wouldn't name my dead corpse pets after my parents. Sherman Hauer should have gotten an Oscar. Should have gotten a nom.
For whatever reason, at least on IMDb, the actor's name is Sherman Howard. I don't know if it's a mistake or not, but he was credited as Howard Sherman. Maybe he didn't want anyone to know he was a zombie. He's like, I don't want to get typecast. I don't understand. And in the movie, the doctor explains that his dad was a surgeon.
Yeah.
So if he was like, my dad was a redneck who didn't know how to do anything and was also like green skinned, you'd be like, oh, I see why you'd call him Bub. But he was like a surgeon and he was your father and you named a zombie after him.
Paging Dr. Bub. And this movie is full of amazing makeup moments. In the Dr. Frankenstein laboratory, when they first introduce him, mm-hmm. there's this zombie who's all cut open. They're doing an autopsy and studying zombies. And he breaks up off of the table and sits up and his guts spill out.
Yeah, he's got a nice big chest rib cage.
Oh, man.
All the guts fall out.
It's super gross. And then he the zombie's still menacing the main character lady. And Dr. Frankenstein runs up and drills him in the head. And it's super simple, but it's mm-hmm. so effective and gross. And
yeah.
And this movie is full of just solid, practical gore makeup effects. And I mean, later when everything falls apart and the zombies overtake the base, one of the soldiers gets grabbed and they pull his head off.
Oh yeah, and they have their fingers in the eye sockets as they pull. Yeah.
And as they pull him, he's screaming, but as his vocal cords get stretched, the voice pitch goes up. And
awesome.
That was a specific, Romero was like, that's what would happen. Let's have that happen.
And it's amazing.
It's really gross. And then the main antagonist, this Colonel Rhodes
mm-hmm.
character, he's the big guy in charge, and he's trying to kill all the zombies, and we're going to go find something else. But, there's nowhere for them to go. He turns out to be a total jerk, and he's played really well by Joseph Pilato, but he has one of the greatest zombie disembowelings.
One of the most well-known and well-remembered.
There's a famous story behind it, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention it.
Go for it.
They attack him. They rip him apart, and what they're pulling out of him are real pig guts. They went to a butcher shop and got them. But the day before they did this scene where he gets ripped in half, they didn't refrigerate the guts. So they loaded him up, his fake body up, with rotten, gross pig guts. And when he rips open, the look on his face is real. 100% like,
because
oh,
he smells real
man.
Pig guts.
Yeah, real rotting pig guts. And that is so real. And those zombie actors commit because they pull those guts out and bring them up to their faces. And I'm just like,
they were earning their $34 a day.
Right? That moment is awesome too because while he's being ripped apart, Bub looks at him and salutes him.
Yes, which is a callback to a scene earlier in the film.
Yeah.
Another cool thing with that actor, Joseph Pilato, people don't know, he was actually also in Dawn of the Dead. Not as the same character. He played a police officer at the docks. Now, I'd have to double check, but it might just be in the director's cut that you see that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely the same guy for sure, which is kind of cool.
That is interesting.
And I watched both of those movies this week, and I had to go back to see if it's supposed to be an evolution of the character, because that would be kind of an interesting thing. I don't know that it was intended to be, but it definitely was the same actor.
Well, I mean, he earns the rank of colonel pretty fast if he's the same character.
Well, if you're underground with 12 other guys, you could probably move up pretty fast.
Well, I have a funny story about that guy.
About him specifically?
Him specifically, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm with one of my first college roommates, my friend Guy.
I'm jealous.
I know. We're hanging out in a weird bar in Glendale, and we're talking about zombie stuff.
This is after college, though?
This is after college. Mm-hmm. We're talking about zombies, talking about makeup, talking about horror movies. And this guy behind us is like, these kids these days, they don't appreciate good horror movies. What's the best headshot you've ever seen in a movie?
He said this to you?
To me.
Yeah.
And I turn around and I go, Dawn of the Dead. And he goes, Dawn? No way. It's Day of the Dead. And I look at him. I'm like, oh, my God. It's Colonel Rhodes from Day of the Dead. And he was in there. And I was like, well, you know, Day of the Dead is good, too. But, I mean, I think the headshot, you know, anyway.
Which headshot was he talking? Was he talking about a specific one?
He was. I don't remember exactly which one it was.
He was drunk.
We got him drunk. So yeah, we're talking, and he goes, which one of you guys is going to buy me a tequila shot? And we started doing tequila shots all night long.
Was he by himself?
Yeah. To the point that, like, Guy and I were like, no more, dude. We can't. Like, we had, like, a side powwow. And we're like, we can't keep buying this guy drinks. Like, we're spending all of our money. I'm so messed up right now.
Was he trying to, like, take over the rest of the group with his M16 like he did in the movie? I'm the captain.
He just wanted us to buy him a bunch of drinks. He talked to us all night. We hung out and talked about zombie movies all night, but he was definitely like, kids these days don't appreciate good horror. And here's another funny thing. He's like, where'd you kids go to school? We went Emerson. He goes, oh, I went to Emerson too.
What?
Yeah.
No shit?
No shit.
Why does Emerson keep making zombies?
I know, right? So I thought that was funny too, but like, you know, he was a fun guy to hang out with.
That's pretty interesting, dude.
We bought him way too many tequila shots. I mean, we got, he was still, I don't want to say standing, he was sitting at a bar, but he was still able to talk. We had to stumble home, man. We couldn't hang.
Did you rip him in half before you left?
No, I just saluted him.
Oh, man. Day of the Dead is a great movie, and it's one of those that, like, kind of, not just in terms of, like, actual years, but the times that you see it, it kind of ages well,
yes.
Like wine. The first couple times I saw it, I was like, the effects are good, but as a movie, it's slow. Mm-hmm. It's definitely slow.
It is.
Dawn of the Dead was actually pretty talky. There's a lot of non-zombie talking parts,
yeah.
But it paced well. This one, there's a lot of talking, a lot of not zombie action stuff.
Yeah.
But if you really watch it, it's kind of, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
There's a couple really human moments in it where, like at the beginning of the movie, one of the main characters, a female protagonist, she's sitting in a room by herself and she's looking at a calendar that has pumpkins, like a pumpkin field. And she is like looking at this and you could tell that she's like, I have not been in a field in a long time. I haven't seen pumpkins.
Oh, yeah.
She kind of walks up and touches it, and then it's a dream sequence, and then there's a scare. But
what's the scare?
As she touches, I think she's dreaming, and as she touches the calendar, which is against a cinder block wall, so
yep.
You know you're underground, all these zombie hands burst out and grab at her, and she wakes up.
Yeah, super, like, cool. It's great.
And I did not expect, I've seen the movie before, rewatching it the other day, I did not expect that to happen. But you really feel for this character. Normally in a zombie movie, I'm like, I don't care about how other people feel. Kill them. Rip them in half. But like, you're like, I understand how she feels. Then she's got like a slight romantic interest who ends up getting contaminated, and she has to machete his arm off.
Yeah.
She machetes his arm off. She cauterizes it. There's a huge standoff between the army guys and her about killing him. That all diffuses, and this is like a 5-10 minute scene. And at the end of that, she looks at another guy who's like on her side, and she just breaks down, starts crying, and they hug it out. And it's like, it doesn't do anything for the film except further her character.
Yeah.
But it's crucial. It's very important. And I remember feeling for her, like, in that it was an extremely effective scene emotionally.
It's amazing.
And you don't see that in a lot of zombie movies.
From Day of the Dead, it really, I mean, those were the big three. But after that, like, I mean, zombies exploded. It took a while for them to ramp up to the fever pitch that I think we're on the tail end of. And I think, like, there has been, in the past 5 years, there's been a gigantic wave of zombies.
And I think it's because of The Walking Dead is a very big stoke to that fire.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, and it's tough now, because if you're not doing it as well as The Walking Dead, you're kind of in the margins of just another crappy zombie reboot.
Yeah.
But as far as like other non-Romero zombie movies, let's just mention some quick ones. What are some of your favorite non-Romero zombie movies?
There's many things I like about the 28 Days series. It's got problems, but I like the idea of a fast movie zombies. I like the idea that it's not traditional zombies coming back from the dead. It's a virus. But it's still the same very basic premise, and I think it deals with a lot of issues in a real-world way. And as far as a production, it's super cool that they closed down so many parts of England to get such iconic shots of, you know, after civilization, you know, in a huge urban media area. This is so cool.
I think my favorite one is the Lord of the Rings Peter Jackson directed Brain Dead or Dead Alive.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about that. Yeah.
I think in America, it's called Dead Alive.
Mm-hmm.
It is what I like to call splatstick, and it's it's comedy. Like, the movie's very much a comedy.
Sure.
But it is still, I think, to this day, the goriest film ever made. The most gallons of blood, the most guts. It is just disgusting.
What'd you call it? Splatstick?
Splatstick.
I like that. You should be a professional word maker-upper. Like, at least, like, terms. Like, someone could be like, what should we call this? You're like, pulp culture. What should we call this? Splatstick.
Thanks, man.
What's this fork called? That's Dinglehopper. That is a great movie, though, and I forgot. That's another one that I watched at the same time as I discovered that.
Yeah.
I discovered it the same time as I rediscovered Dawn and discovered Day for the first time, where I was like, wow, this is just incredible.
Amazing, amazing practical effects. Over the top. It's so over the top. I mean, the big climax is he walks into a house full of zombies with a lawnmower strapped to his chest and just walks through them.
That's the kind of movie that, as a practical special effects guy, you wish you had a director or a company come to you and say, listen, we want to make a movie. This is what we want. This is what we want to see on camera. You'd be like, this is amazing.
This is amazing. And I love that one. I mean, Shaun of the Dead was a lot of fun.
That was the other one I was going to say, is because that's another funny one that has taken what's been before, and now we're looking at it through the lens of comedy, but still does a great job with the zombie aspect of it.
Is Evil Dead zombies? They're demons, right?
I wouldn't really call that a zombie movie. There's zombie-esque things in it.
They're good splatstick, though.
Yes, for sure.
What did you think of the Dawn of the Dead remake, the Zack Snyder
the
one?
The Dawn of the Dead? First time I saw it, I loved it up until just after the title sequence. I thought up until the title sequence with the
little girl.
Oh, yeah. And then Sarah Polley is the main female lead. Mm-hmm. She gets out, and as she's escaping, we follow her. She hits a couple neighbors and stuff.
Oh,
and then there's this big overhead shot that shows like that shit is going down everywhere and there's fires and stuff.
Yeah.
And then you hear the Man in Black guitar start.
It's pretty cool.
There's a man going around taking names.
Johnny Cash, what are you doing here?
I think it's great, and it works. It's so awesome. Then it lost me when it got to the mall the first time I saw it. Having rescreened it, effects-wise, awesome. It's not just a redo. It's not just a retread of the first one, which would be boring. So the second couple times I've seen it, a second, third, fourth viewings, I like it a lot more. It's a lot of fun.
I'm really into it. I mean, I wish they weren't remaking movies. I mean, I wish it was just another zombie movie, but
agreed.
I don't think it does a disservice to the name Dawn of the Dead.
I agree.
Here's a question I got to ask you, because this is a very divisive moment in the movie, and I have an opinion about it that many people disagree with. How do you feel about Zombie Baby?
Awesome. Great.
Thank you. High five, Rumi.
We haven't seen it before. Right? Yeah. not that I could think of. We have it's probably been in a movie before. Although that's not true. There's the Zombie Baby in Dead Alive, isn't there? Yeah.
But the Zombie Baby in Dead Alive is played purely for laughs.
Correct. And this is way more mainstream than Dead Alive ever was.
The thing that I love about this, and everybody, so many people are like, oh, you lost me at the Zombie Baby. But this is, like we said in the first one, Mekhi Phifer has a pregnant wife, and he will do anything to protect her and to protect his child. The wife's sick. She's obviously bit. He even at one point is keeping the zombie wife alive in the hopes that his baby will be okay.
Sure, right.
And then the baby's born, and he looks at it, and it's a zombie. And the effects are a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
It looks weird.
Yeah, right, right.
And I'll, you know, to anybody who's like, I'm off because of that, I understand. But for me, I was so still into it because it twists this moment that should be really important for him. Everything he's ever wanted is to be a father and have this child.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns it on its head into something disgusting, perverting it into something horrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
And it starts killing people and they end up having to kill the baby. That's gnarly.
I agree.
And took it to a level that I thought was super effective.
And killing kids is always awesome in a movie.
I love that.
I think that's a really decisive thing to put in your film if you're not just doing it for exploitation reasons. You know what I mean? Like, when it's a powerful moment, like I believe it is in this remake,
yeah,
you're not just doing it to kill a kid to kill a kid. I think that's a heavy round to chamber in your gun. You know what I mean?
Big time. And they do it because it's the arc of Mekhi Phifer, him wanting to be a dad and trying to be a dad. And I think they did a great job of building that moment. But, yeah, the baby's a little weird looking. And I think to a lot of people it's off-putting enough that that's kind of where they're out. But I'm still on board. And this movie also has one of my favorite chainsaw moments.
Yep. I knew that was coming.
Yeah. Where they're in the bus escaping, and they have chainsaws that they can, like, stick out the side of the bus. But things go wrong, and the chainsaw ends up cutting this woman in half inside the bus. Right. One of the not a survivor anymore, but and it is a super gnarly effect, and it was practical too. And the way they did is they built a torso that you could actually cut into with a chainsaw, and then reload it with a blood cartridge.
Right,
they could do it over and over again.
Speaking of those buses, and now this is the most important thing for me to ask you, me and you are trapped in a mall. There's zombies.
Mm-hmm.
Me, you, and a bunch of other people, we decide we're getting out of here in these buses. But the buses are not ready for us to leave in yet.
Okay.
We got to put spikes on them. We got to put a snowplow on the front and everything.
Yep.
You have finished securing the chain link fences to reinforce the windows so that no zombies will get us.
Copy.
And you hear, shh, shh, from the front of the bus. You walk around, and I am taking the time to spray paint shark teeth on the snowplow. Are you like, Rumi, this is a catastrophic event that we're trying to survive? Or you say, that looked awesome, man.
I high five the shit out of you. I give you one of the biggest high fives you've ever had. That is awesome.
I figured that's where you would land on it.
I'd be trying to paint. I'm trying to look, where else can I put a shark teeth? Where else can we? I'm going to do a bumblebee stripe over here.
Like, me and you are spray painting the bus as the other people are inside being like, screw it, let's go. just leave them.
They're like, should we leave those two guys who are dressing like it's Mad Max?
They're like, you guys should go paint the other bus. Guys, get in this bus, get in this bus.
Quick, leave those guys. Wait, don't walk away.
Oh, man. Well, for sure, Romero did an amazing job with this trilogy.
Yep.
He really set the groundwork for zombies in American cinema. Unfortunately, we lost him. It was this year, right?
Yeah, just in the past few months. Yeah, we lost George Romero. It was really sad. But like I said, I'm glad we have the movies that we did.
Yeah, he just did so much. I wonder, though, if his work is not yet done. And we're just waiting for a satellite to crash. He comes back and makes the first zombie-written, zombie-directed zombie movie.
He just makes a living person movie.
Film of the Living Dead? Oh, my God. Romero, don't take our idea.
But in all reality, there is one more movie left.
Yeah.
He had a script for Road of the Living Dead, which was another zombie movie.
Because he did
in his
two more movies after, part of the same series, but not as widely received as Dawn and Day and Night.
He did Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead.
Oh, Survival.
And Survival of the Dead,
right?
Yeah.
So he did three, yeah.
Yeah.
Forgot about Diary.
They are their own thing. We don't need to include them here.
Correct. Oh, no. Romero, you only just invented the American zombie movie.
Yeah. Quit trying to show off.
I would say he's rolling over in his grave right now, but that would just make me excited.
Oh, man. Well, for Famous Monsters Podcast, I'm Aaron.
I'm Matt.
And if you want to check out more Famous Monsters, you can see them on Facebook at FMOFL. You can check them out on Twitter and Instagram at Famous Monsters. And on YouTube, they have a YouTube channel where they do Famous Monsters TV at Famous Monsters.
And if you want to hear more from Aaron and I, you can check out The Rocketeers on our own podcast, The Launchpad Podcast. You can find that on your favorite podcatcher.
You can also check us out on our website, launchpadpod.com. And we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Launchpad Pod.
So definitely check out The Walking Dead Season 8 on AMC October 22nd.
Until next week, this has been Famous Monsters Podcast. We're the Rocketeers, signing off.